We have in the studio as our guest Mr. Harry Badger, often referred to by people of Fairbanks as the Strawberry King. Mr. Badger, would you tell us when and the why of that name?
Well, I started raising strawberries about 25 years ago up on the ranch, and I had a good many of them. I used to bring down 15 or 20 crates a day. I kept that up for about 25 years.
These plants, I understand, were a cross between a strawberry that were brought from the States and the native strawberry?
They were.
Where was your home in the States, and what brought you to the North?
Well, my original home, do you mean?
Yes, your original home, or where were you living when you first heard of the North and decided to come?
Well, I was living in Burlington, Washington, when I first heard of the strike up here in the North.
Now, how did you hear of that strike? By newspapers or radio?
No, there were some fellows that came in here in 1897. I didn't come till 1900. And they came back in 1909, and fellows that had never had over $2 or $3 in their pockets at one time came back with $3,000 or $4,000. And I couldn't resist the temptation. I said, I'll go and take a try at it. Mm-hmm. So we did.
You'd been doing some work in Washington, hadn't you?
We were trying to dig out some of those big fir stumps there that over Bill McKay's cut-off logging country. It was a pretty slow job. It would take about a month to get one of those stumps out. Of course, you had quite a lot of ground cleared when it was out, but it was a big job.
Where did you first make your home in the North?
Dawson.
You remained there for how many years?
3 years.
And then?
Then we heard of a strike down here. The man that, Captain Barnett, that came up the river to start a trading post up at Tanmaw Crossing got stuck in the river. The water was too low. And he unloaded here at Fairbanks. And he had a big stock of goods and there was no customers. So Mr. Pedro had a good prospect on Pedro Creek, but no pay at the time. But it was enough for Cap to send a Jap by the name of Waddy up to Dawson to report 9 feet of pay dirt here. That's 9 feet up into the thick, and that was richer than anything we had there. Measured by a pan or a shovel full of dirt is a pan,
mm-hmm.
and 9 feet of pay dirt that would go 25 cents to the pan was pretty rich.
Mm-hmm.
So we came down here to see about it.
Did you find that there had been a strike made when you arrived?
It was a good prospect, that was all.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Pedro let us go down in his hole, and we scraped the bedrock and got 3 cents a pan by scraping bedrock, which was not pay. It was a good prospect.
Mm-hmm. There were many of the miners that came to Fairbanks from Dawson at that time on that rumor of a gold strike.
Oh,
how did they feel about it?
They didn't feel very good about it. They threatened to hang the Jap.
Were there any courts or law here at that time?
No, there was nothing. We made our own laws as we needed them with a miners' meeting.
Mm-hmm.
They put up notices for a miners' meeting, and they all gather at a designated place. They'd elect a secretary and a chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And the verdict was rendered by the bunch that were there.
How did they handle the case of the Jap? I understand that they really felt so against him that they wanted to lynch him, but that he was brought to trial.
He was brought to trial, all right, and he was pretty near scared to death. I really don't think that they intended to lynch him. I think they intended to scare him, and they did. They succeeded thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to be chairman of that meeting, and the poor little fellow was just come up to my shoulder, stood up under my arm, and he was shaking like a leaf.
Mm-hmm. Well, was there a verdict rendered?
Oh, yes. They said they'd let him go this time, not to do it again.
Well, I understand that they... what did they do? What about the flour and the supplies?
Well, Cap had about 17 tons of flour.
That's Cap Barnett.
Cap Barnett.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't sell any of that flour. If you bought a sack, a 50-pound sack of flour, you had to take 3 cases of canned goods that weren't fit to eat. That was canned cabbage and canned beets and canned spinach, none of which were any good. At $12 a case, that was $36 out of a $75 order. You had to have a $75 order and take 3 cases of this stuff to get a sack of flour. Well, a lot of the fellows didn't have the price anyway, so we decided that Cap had better sell his flour one sack at a time and without any strings attached to it, which we passed that resolution and put up notices to that effect. And inside of 2 hours afterward, there was a string a half a mile long walking in the front end of the store and out the back end, each with a sack of flour on his shoulder.
That was one way of getting around the getting food for the miners and at the same time sort of punishing the Jap.
Exactly.
In a roundabout way.
Yeah.
Well, when and where was gold struck then in the Fairbanks district?
Well, the first that we got any rumor of was on Fairbanks Creek, 8 above Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob McChesney, who afterward became the first editor of the News Miner, and I walked out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we found the fellows on 8 above, went down, and like all prospectors at that time, everybody gave the other one information if they had it. It was
mm-hmm.
customary. We asked them what they had there, and they told us it was none of their our business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of surprised, and I said, well, we've taken a long walk out here, and if hundreds of people that are trying to find out whether there's any pay in this country or not, would you let me take a pan of gravel off? Says, get off the claim and stay off it. And all right. So we went up on the hill and sat down and ate our lunch and thought it over a while, and we sat there until the guys went to bed and the smoke quit. I sneaked down the hill with a bandana handkerchief and scooped up what dirt I could carry in that handkerchief off of this dump. We went up the creek and panned it in an old greasy frying pan and got $2.50.
Hmm, sounds like quite a pastry.
So we were quite elated. We came back to Fairbanks and reported it. And then we got word in a few days that they had struck it on Clary Creek, on Discovery Creek, down close to the mouth of Wolf Creek.
Mm-hmm.
We went down there, and there was a man by the name of Lon Doggett that I knew well up in the upper country. He was running a long tom, hoisting out of the hole and washing it in a long tom. That's an elongated rocker.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him what he had, and he said, wait till I get this hopper empty and I'll show you something. Took the hopper lid off, and it was a string of gold from the top of that thing down to the bottom. He says, we have to clean up every 2 hours to keep it from running over.
Mm-hmm.
We came back to town and opened up a real estate office.
By the way, how was real estate handled in those days? I mean, both from the private enterprise and a matter of recording and staking.
Well, at a town meeting, they elected a town recorder. And anyone that staked a lot had to record it with this town recorder. And they charged him $2.50 for a recording. That meant that that we'd take him out and show him where his lots were, and then write down the number of the lot and his name in this book and charge him $2.50 for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, how did the private real estate agent come into the picture? You, for instance, were handling both the recording and then dabbling in real estate in a private matter?
As far as the real estate business, buying and selling was concerned, all you had to do was hang out your shingle. We didn't have to have any licenses or anything of the kind.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I did.
Well, I was wondering where you could stake a lot for $2.50, why anyone would want to buy a lot.
A good many people left here that summer on account of not being paid here. They went away by the thousands, the same as they came in that way. And lots of them would get a cabin up and then discover that they were fed up with the country and get out, and they'd sell it for anything they could get for it, $25 or $30 or whatever
mm-hmm.
they happened to get.
Mm-hmm.
And those were easily sold for
yes.
twice or three times the amount when somebody come in and want to stake a lot. Sell him one with a cabin already on it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the real estate agent would do. He would
yes.
buy the real estate, the property with a cabin, when the man wanted to sell, and hold it until someone arrived that wanted
yeah,
to buy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was there a time limit on when they had to build a cabin on these
lots?
They
had to build a cabin in 30 days
mm-hmm.
after staking.
Mm-hmm. Were there any cases where they could have a leave of absence?
They get a 30-day leave of absence to go to Circle after grub.
Oh, yes. That was the nearest point where they...
That was the nearest mm-hmm. place that you could get any food.
How did they go by grub? Dog team or...
Dog team. That's the only way to go. The only mm-hmm. way there was of traveling.
Did any of them go just pulling the sled themselves?
Yeah, there was one old guy that went over there, a big Swede. They called him Ole. He was a great friend of Judge Wickersham's, and he went over after grub, and he's a big, strong 6.5 feet tall and weigh about 300 pounds. And he put 700 pounds on his sled. He had no dogs. Put 700 pounds on his sled and just went all right until he got to where he had to go up the hill. His moccasins were kind of slippery, and he couldn't keep his footing going up. So he took off 300 pounds off of the sled and put it on his back, and that held him down so he pulled his load over the hill.
Another one of the real or mythical stories of the big Swede or Ole.
Yeah, quite right.
How do you feel about your years in Alaska? That is, compared to your life in the States before you came to the North, or compared to life in Alaska today?
Well, life in Alaska today, I don't like it very well, especially around the towns. But my experience in the North has been something I wouldn't trade off for all that I missed outside. I like it so much better, the attitude of the people. The first years here, we never locked our doors anywhere. We'd go in, stay for a week, and leave our cabins wide open. And the only thing we'd ever notice, sometimes we'd come back and find a set of dirty dishes and somebody say thank you for the meal.
Well, where do you make your home now, Mr. Badger?
On the Badger Ranch up on the Badger Road.
Mm-hmm.
Been there for 38 years.
You're still homesteading it or farming? I suppose out in your neighborhood there are still people who come out and live in the country and feel that they're living in the wilderness and that they are roughing it, having it tough.
Oh, yes, they're having a tough time. They come out there and if they're not within 10 feet of the highway, why, they want the road commission to immediately put a road in with gravel on it that they can't farm unless they can have access to their places right quick.
Mm-hmm.
I packed my grub on the back from Fairbanks up there for the first couple of years.
I didn't ask you how you came to Dawson, whether it was by riverboat or... and also how you came from Dawson to Fairbanks. Did you come by riverboat or...?
Well, we pulled a sled by the neck from Skagway to Dawson. Excepting on Bennett, I acquired one dog. The other fellows... was eight of us, six of us in the party, and they pulled their own sleds, two men to each sled, and they pulled it by hand.
Mm-hmm.
We were 40 days on the trail. We camped out every night. We landed in Dawson on the 5th day of March, 1900.
Mm-hmm. And then you came to Fairbanks the same way, didn't you?
Well, I had a dog team coming down here.
Oh, you did?
We came down as far as the 40 mile and went up to Joe Creek, and from there across the divide into the extreme head of the Good Pasture River. And followed that down to the Tanana down to the north of this slough, and from there into Fairbanks.
Hmm.
We're 33 days from Dawson here.
40 days into Dawson and 30 days into Fairbanks, and now the trip from Whitehorse, which would be a comparative distance, can be made in 3 or 4 hours.
I'll see.
Harry Badger, may I ask your age?
85. 85, my next birthday.
85. I'm going to make a wish. If I should reach the age of 85, may I walk as straight and as spryly as you do and be able to review the years with the same gleam in my eyes. It's been a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon.
Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Our guest this evening is a gentleman from Livengood. We had one earlier visitor from Livengood in the early part of our Here's a Pioneer series. Perhaps you'll remember L. Tom Carr, prospector out in the Livengood area. Our guest this evening is Ben Fall, who just came in from Livengood for, I guess, a little shopping this weekend. And we want to talk to him a bit about when he first came up to Alaska.
Well, that was in 1902.
And you landed where?
I landed in Whitehorse from Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
I helped to build those river steamers that first was built for pastures going down to Dawson.
Well, what was your work like, Mr. Falls?
Well, my work was the joining work on the river steamers. And after that year, I went back to work in the spring of 1900, and now this is 1902 that I was in 1901, I made that mistake, but 1902, mm-hmm. I helped to build another boat that sailed down to the Keokuk,
mm-hmm.
and that was 1902. I went up the Keokuk River And I heard about the strike up at Coldfoot, and I built me a small boat and pulled up Coldfoot. And I didn't see so very much there. It was pretty expensive country, so I met another man by the name of Gandolfa. He was well-known in Dawson as a real estate man. He'd been up looking over this town site, and he didn't like it very much, so he decided to come with me back downriver on this skiff, and we'd get to the mouth of the Keokuk River and get a steamer and get up to Dawson again. But we changed our mind. He had a horse, and we started out overland, and we traveled with this horse, and we had Gordon Bettles with us, an old-timer, and another man by the name of Bill Batchmore. And we came together across country and landed at the Yukon, Fort Stevens now, which should be Fort Hamlin, an old trading post. And there was only a chief Indian that had a place there then. But we was pretty well starved out, and we got something to eat from the old chief.
Well, now, you mentioned the man named Bettles. Is that the man after whom this village of Bettles
yes,
is named?
Yes, that's Gordon Bettles.
And who was he?
Well, he was used to be an editor in Detroit, as I heard him say, maybe before he came to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a mining man in there, had some ground. And he came with us out. He went up to Dawson to see if he could raise some money to exploit some mining
mm-hmm.
in there.
Now, you mentioned Stevens Village, which used to be Fort Hamilton, you say?
Well, they called it Fort Hamlin. Fort Hamlin, I think
Hamlin.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Hamlin. And that's just 6 miles below the mouth of Dawn River, where that was just an Indian village, but nobody had lived there at the mouth of Dawn River when we landed out. So we had to go down that side of the river and cross over to the trading post. At least there was no trading post there then, but an old chief Indian had this log cabin, quite a big cabin. They called that Fort Hamlin.
Hmm. Well, I wonder why they called it a fort if it had been...
Well, I wouldn't know.
You didn't...
That's just...
Wasn't a military deal at all.
That's just
the way
they named it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what'd you do after that? How was your boat trip, by the way, when you came down, you four men? Did you get any difficulties?
The boat that I... four of us didn't come down. This man, Gandolfa, and Gordon Bettles were going upriver.
Oh.
And we heard about the stampede, or at least there wasn't no stampede, but we heard about a strike here in the upper Tanana. And we thought we'd go down as far as Rampart and see what we could find out about it. And there we stayed at Rampart, and we done some work and for a man by the name of Sam Heater. We cut some hay for his horses, and we had a time of it. Anyway, and we stayed around there till February before we started up the Tanana River. We had to come over the divide from Rampart across Glen Gulch and down Baker Creek and onto the Tanana River. And there we mushed up, but Heater had taken a string of cayuses or horses and double-ender sleds and was hauling a load of freight in. And we went along with him and helped him out. And the snow was very deep, so he was pretty slow making the trip up, and he just got about as far as Nenana when he had to go back and haul some more feed that far. So we came on then together on a small sled, piled our stuff on that, and hauled it into Chino.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know which... There wasn't any Chino there much, and there wasn't any Fairbanks. It was just...
Chino's the little village now abandoned
yes,
down
that's
the river.
An old, the first village that they started there, and there, and here in Fairbanks, there wasn't anything here, but people were coming on account of the strike that they'd heard about. Hundreds of people come along, and they pitched camp and tents, and then they started to build themselves a cabin all along the waterfront here, which you don't see anymore now because there was a fire that burned them all down.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about all the street they had then, you know, that winter. But Chino had a row of cabins the same. And they didn't know which was going to be the navigating headquarters for the boats coming up river. That was the most important of many, so they thought Chenum would be all right. And anyway, Barnett had his trading post here, and people come here to get provisions, and they camped here. And of course, the judge decided that if they'd called Fairbanks, that he'd name start the courthouse here or something like that. You see,
that was when Mr. Fairbanks was a senator.
That was about the first summer.
Mm-hmm.
But mind you, this is the winter of 1903. Now, and towards spring, the people start to leave here. they all built rafts to go down river in the spring, and some of them had got back out over the trail towards Circle, and they were leaving by the hundreds. But there were some of us that I had bought a horse, and I tried to save it for myself, and there was no feed for the horses. There was 100 or more horses died of starvation, but I managed to keep mine off the grass that was out on these swales, these lakes. I used that horse the next summer for prospecting.
Hmm.
And instead of staying here where I should have stayed in Fairbanks, I went across country where we heard, there was a man that come in here from that district, and he said that he thought I'd take my horse, we'd find a good country. And that's Livengood District today.
Is that
so
right?
We tried to find it that summer, but We were pretty close, but we were in the beaver country, and that part was pretty close to the top head of Livengood. Well, my partner was a man by the name of John Patterson. He was as old as I am now, when I was quite a young man, of course. He was, he had lost his life over there. He died. His body was found down on the raft at the log jam. And the marshal heard about it, but nobody brought him remains or anything. I don't know what they did do about it. But he was out in that part of the country long before I went with him. So he was looking for Livengood because he had heard from John Manuke. He was a man, a half-breed Indian that Big Manuke was named after. He would discover Rampart. I understand he was the discoverer of 40 Mile.
Hmm.
And he gave the information because he was with Weatherspoon, the geological surveyor that was here in early days. He was with him when they crossed, I think it was from Circle to Rampart. Or it might have been from Eagle to Rampart. And he described this Livengood district to this partner of mine, John Patterson. So he told me, he said, I think we'll find a good country over there. He'd been over that way, but he hadn't found it. So this is the trip that I made out in summer 1903, which we didn't know whether there were really any pay here in Fairbanks. And everybody left. Just as fast as they come, they went back again. Now it looks to me like people don't know what they really want. If I'd have been older than I was, I had to learn, of course, by experience, too. I might have stayed around Fairbanks District and got in some stakes on the ground, but I didn't think that when everybody was leaving, it didn't look very good to me. So I went to prospecting that summer. Well, I finally had to come in and make some money to buy another grub stake, so I went to work with my carpenter tools, and I worked around here. There was cabins, doors and windows to cut in these cabins and everything, you know. So I helped to build a town here in the early days.
Is that right? Well, you must be a pretty handy man with tools for your boat building,
well,
and house building.
Well, I always have been handy with tools. I've learned two or three different kinds of trades, I would call the shipbuilding is not exactly my trade, but I was pretty good at joining work, and I got the job, and of course, when you can build a boat, you can build a house. That's one thing. If you can build a boat, you can build a house, because Boat work is very nice work, and it has to be very, very neat, well done.
Got to make those joints fit pretty tight.
Uh-huh.
Well, now, a thing that's interested me, I understand you're teaching the tourists a little bit about gold panning out at your...
Yes, they got me down for a kind of a gold panner, all right. There was a contest here in Fairbanks for panning, and of course I didn't like to get in against the old-timers, but I knew that expert that the FE company had was going to win the money. So I had to get in, and of course I got one of the prizes. They were kind of disputing who was going to take the first one, so I walked away from it the minute I got done panning, and I didn't think I'd win anything until some of my friends was meeting me around town and said, "Ben, they're looking for you." I says, "Who's looking for me?" "Oh," he says, "you win a prize." "Oh, maybe," I says, "I'll go and find out." Well, they were looking for me, and finally I wound up about 9 o'clock getting the money. So after that, I said, well, I ought to be qualified to show somebody how to pan after doing that much. Now, I don't know if I can tell you anymore, but I think I better...
Huh?
Not say any more.
Well, I was just... I know I had some friends that went out and...
Is this going on the radio?
Yeah. Huh? Are we telling a secret?
Well, I better be careful. My wife will wonder, at least if she's listening on this, she'll know I got in all right.
Yeah.
Too. Because I had to make a trip in here with a cleanup, and she'll be kind of anxious to know whether I got here or not.
Oh. Well, we're certainly happy you could be with us, and we know you're a champion gold panner, even if you won't talk about it very much. But we certainly do appreciate hearing your stories about the early days, and you gave us a lot of good history.
Well, of course, I could tell her quite a few things that might be more funny than this.
Well, like Ben Fall said when I called him about coming up, he says, maybe I'll say too much. Thank you, Ben Falls, from Live and Good.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I know if you were tuned to our program last week, you're very anxious to get started again this week because our guest for the second time is Sandy Smith, 93-year-old Alaska trailblazer who's back in the territory for the summer. When we left off last week, Sandy, we were where you were just, you just pulled your partner out of a 214-foot hole. What happened after that? You broke up your partnership and...
Yes. We went over to Wild Creek, and it was a new stampede in the Koyukuk country. And we had a miners' meeting there, and they elected me commissioner. And Mike Gallivan was secretary of the miners' meeting. So I bought the books and recorded all the claims. And gathered in about $4,000 recording. And then I started a roadhouse and a store, and I had the freighting and the wood business there.
Mm-hmm.
So that winter, towards spring, we struck water. Everybody struck water. There was no money in camp, and all my provision and everything was all on the book. But previous to that, they wanted a post office, so I kept writing to Washington and suggesting at least a dozen names, but they wouldn't take any of the names. They finally called it Al Malcolm.
That's what I heard just the other day, that there was this little place called Al Malcolm,
and
after
boy,
you...
boy, did the boys razz me for the name of the post office. That was a name for the post office.
Well, I think we ought to repeat again tonight for the benefit of our listeners that weren't with us last week that your official name is Alexander Malcolm Smith, or A. Malcolm.
Yeah. So there was an Indian come over with his wife, and we put him up, and he wanted to see gold, so we showed him gold, and then he wanted a map, and he showed us on the map, he says, a creek full of gold. He was in good faith. He didn't have gold from the pirates of iron, which we found afterwards. So I had a young chap, he's still living,
He's over in McCarthy, been there for a number of years. 2 years ago, I had a letter from him. He says, you better come back home. And he says, I'll look after you. I find out I'm in better shape than he is. So I hope I see him before I go outside.
Is that the little ghost town of McCarthy down in the Kennecott?
Yes. So he says, are you game to go over there? I says, by all means, but what about this impossible? So I wrote to Washington and waited, and they wouldn't let me resign. So I packed everything in a box and shipped it back to Washington. So we went down the river about 14 miles to Michigan Creek, felled a tree, whipsawed it into lumber, floated it down to Bettleson in the Koyukuk, and built a boat. And while we was building the boat, all the old-timers was watching us, saying, what's the matter with you fellas? You're building a coffin. Kidding us all the time. And he says, everybody else has tried to make that trip come back, let alone the government with all the help in the world. So we was afraid to put it in the water when we finished it. But we got up early in the morning, and we had all the provisions, boat and stacked up and put it in there, and we found out it was just the thing that we needed. So we started out the following day, and we started up the John River, and the second day, it got to be awful rapid, the river. My partner and I be in harness, and the seven dogs, we'd be down on all fours, scratching gravel to get that empty boat around the rapids. So it rained the following day, and we were in the tent. Bill said to me, how do you feel? I says, Bill, I never tackled anything in my life that I didn't go through with. I may go back with my dead body going down that river. He says, that's the way that I feel. So we finally got up all the stuff to the summit, and we'd almost worn the canvas sacks out of off the provision by putting it in the boat, taking it on our back, maybe a half a mile, a few yards, and we finally got to the summit. And I went over to look at the creek, and I looked down, I could see all this pirates of iron. So I went back to camp, and Bill says, how does it look? I says, it's there, as the native said, Bill, but it's not gold. Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. I says, well, you better come over. So he was up on the bank about 14 feet above. He says, my God, Sandy, at last we're millionaires. I says, no, Bill, come down and look at it. So he came down and looked at it, and he collapsed right there and then. So we hung around there. I had to go hunt in the Anaktovik Valley. I don't think any white man had been in that valley. It reaches clear to the Canadian boundary line, a wonderful valley, highly mineralized too. But natives had been in there, without a doubt, hunting. There were lots of sheep in there, moose, caribou, ducks, geese, everything. So we finally started down the river. The second day down, there was two big boulders in the middle of the river. And we, Bill looked at it and he said, Sandy's too narrow, what can we do? I says, well, we can't stop, Bill, we'll be swamped, the river was too swift. So I says, give it all the headway you can, Bill. And we hit that middle of that two boulders as fair as anybody could hit it. But a second that the water come in over the back where I was and washed everything out of a boat. But a sack of beans and a sack of flour stuck under the seat. So we finally got the boat out of there and went ashore and went up and down the beach, and we picked up some old cooking utensils and a 5-gallon can of Chinese matches. That's all we saved out of our outfit. So we stayed there for a few days hunting around and looking around. And we started down. There was no channel in the river. There was nothing but rocks. So Bill was on the back end guiding the boat with about 150 feet of rope. And I was on outside of the boat on the front with the gunwale of the boat under my arm. And I was jumping from rock to rock to guide the boat through the rocks. And there was one jump too much for me. So the boat got away from me, and Bill come in the river, and I can see him yet. First his legs, and then his feet, and then his hands, tumbling all over, until finally I got on land and pulled him in. And it was so comical, you know what, I had to laugh. He says, "Damn you, I had to kill you." I says, "Well, Bill, it was so comical that I couldn't help, even if you do come, I couldn't help myself." So we finally got down to the mouth of the Coble River. Second day we were caught in ice with that open boat. Drifting east one day and west the next day. And all we had to eat was the beans, but fortunately they would be soft and grown again, and we'd brush the sprouts off and chew them. And the last 100 yards we thought we'd never get ashore from that pancake ice. We tried everything else, but we couldn't move at all. So we finally got the idea of putting a sail up and rocking the boat. And it took us 2 days to make that 100 yards to get ashore. And when we got ashore, the dogs run up inland about a quarter of a mile. And there was a little willow sticking up in the mud. And I called on the dogs. They paid no attention to me. First time my dogs ever disobeyed me. So I finally went over and I said, "What's the matter with you fellas?" And they looked at the willow, you know, and then looked at me as much as say, "Well, you fool, here's land. See if you can stay on it."
First time they'd seen a tree for months, huh?
Yeah, that's right. So we started along to go to Barrow. It was 450 miles away. And we couldn't get enough of driftwood to cook the flour. We'd take the water out of the ocean, which is just salt enough, you know. And we'd warm it up and swallow it down, just like a strawberry sundae or something like that. Every time I see a paper hanger, hanging paper, I go and look at his face and think to myself, "Oh, what a wonderful time we could have had if we could have cooked it that much." So I run ahead of the dogs, and all of a sudden, plump, I went in up to the knees and something. And I shouted to Bill, I says, "Stay back, Bill." So he stood back, and he said, "What is it?" I says, "I don't know." So I flattened myself out, and I could, every inch or so, I would feel it like I just sucking me down there. Took me 2 hours to get out of that. Bill was helpless. He couldn't get near me. Couldn't do anything for me.
Quicksand? Quicksand? What was it?
No. Oil. Petroleum.
Oh.
You know, I believe I'm the only thing that ever got in there that ever got out alive. Mastodon in there, prehistoric horses, caribou, ducks, geese, swan, everything under the sun got mired in there. So I finally flattened myself out and scratched my way out. And Bill looked at it and he says, "My God, Sandy, it's oil." And I says, "It is." He said, "What are we going to do?" He said, "Let's look around a little more." So I says, "All right." So we started looking around there for a day and a half. And this oil, with the warmth of my body, was dripping off my clothes onto the snow. Some Eskimos come along from Herschel Island going to Barrow, saw the tracks of the white men and over the side of the white man's feet, and the drippings of oil. We were going around in circles, you know, looking around. And they got to Barrow and said to the trader, "Two crazy white men wandering around back east." So the second day, we run across, we went on a little mound and looked down on the second lake, this little one, 7.5 acres. So we finally went to Barrow, and Charlie Brower kept us for about 3 weeks to fatten us up. We were pretty weak. I was pulling the sled with the harness. The dogs were all in. They couldn't do anything. And I was laying in so far to that rope, I was weak, you know. And I thought, my God, he's a wonderful, strong man. But they didn't know, I was just keeping myself from falling over.
Yeah.
So when we got ready to go, Charlie gave us some new dogs and a little sled and a little grub. So we started down the course towards Cape Lisburn. And we got the Yukatok River. And that reaches to the summit of the Brooks Range, which the north end runs into the Arctic Ocean and the south end of the Bering Sea. And we discovered one of the largest coal fields that there is anywhere. It's standing 40 feet high there in places there wasn't 24 inches of silt or mud on top of that. And we got caught in a storm about 20 miles from the summit. And we'd walk around the sled, one in a sleeping bag, and walk around the sled. Took 20 minutes in the sleeping bag. We were afraid to take any longer. And I had Bill beaten almost to a pulp to get him up and walk around the sled. And our sleeping bags, we'd been breathing in them. They froze up, but we couldn't go into them. And we just had a couple of canvases, and we'd put a sleeping bag down, lie on top of them, get all the dogs around us, and throw the canvas over us. And the third morning, I heard some dogs. So I said, Bill, some people here. Oh, he said, you're bugs, you're hearing things. I said, no, get up, come on, we've got to go. So we got our things together and started out. In about a quarter of an hour, we run into a little igloo with some Bering Sea Eskimos. And it wasn't any more than 10 by 12 at the most. And they had 12 dogs in there and 14 people. And they'd been in there for 7 days and seven nights. And they had nothing to eat any more than we had. So they asked him where we were going. We told him Point Hope. He says, oh, you can go through that canyon. So we says, we've got to go. We've got no grub, no dog feed. All we had to eat from the time we left the Bering Sea was 2 pounds of butter apiece. At 2 o'clock, we'd take a chunk of butter and a drink of water. And the poor dogs look around at us much as say, don't we deserve something? We have nothing to give them. Nothing to give them. So he says, you can go through there. So I says, well, we've got to go, Bill. So he says, oh no, you can't go with travel, no good, no good. We finally started out. The canyon walls was anyway from 4 to 5 feet, 400, 500 feet high.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Our guest this evening is a lady that's familiar to many of you, I know. She's a longtime resident of Fairbanks, a hard worker down at the USO, and just a all-around nice person. We're extremely happy to introduce another lady old-timer from the North, Mrs. George Gasser.
Are we doing this over?
Yeah, we're going to start in again. We had a little trouble with our recording earlier, but we're going to start and have Mrs. Gasser tell her story all over again. I know where to start you this time. Let's start with how you happened to come to Alaska.
Oh, well, I came to Alaska because my brother represented the SYT company in here, and they wanted to do something pleasant for him. And they asked me if I would take a trip to Alaska. And, of course, I was very glad to do so. So I came in and saw him at St. Michael's. Had a nice 10 days there, and then went back to Seattle. Then the next year, they gave me the trip again. Then eventually I came to Seattle. He was mining. And I came to spend the winter with him. And he said he would buy me a return trip ticket to Seattle, but not a single one. So I stayed. I didn't go back. And then 2 years later, Mr. Gasser came to the experiment station, and I'm still here.
Well, now we're getting to a subject that's, to me, very interesting, and that is the work at the experiment station in Rampart. Mm-hmm. Because in those early days, why, gee, there couldn't have been much of any kind of agriculture in Alaska.
Well, Mr. Gasser was a plant breeder, and he worked mostly with grains. And we had grains from all over the world, from all cold countries to experiment with. And of course, selections were made from the hardiest ones. He was working constantly for earliness and hardiness.
Now, he was sent in by the federal government. Did that have anything to do with the Matanuska experiment, or this was before that, wasn't it?
That was before the Matanuska. The Matanuska, I don't remember what year the Matanuska was started, but the Rampart station was the first one in the interior. And then later the Matanuska was started and the Fairbanks station was started. There was also a station at Sitka. The station at Sitka worked mostly with fruit trees and berries.
Well, how had they happened to select Rampart as a site? Was there anything there when you first went there? In the way of experiment work?
Oh, yes. Fred Rader started that place. Mr. Grasser succeeded Mr. Rader. He came from California, and he went back to California. But he built the station, he built the house, and cleared the land, and did some experimenting.
Well, did Mr. Rader select Rampart as a site, or had there been some kind of a survey made?
No, Dr. Georgeson did that. And I don't know why he selected it. But when Mr. Gasser's interviewed, he can tell you.
Well, it is on the bank of a river. That probably has something to do with it.
Well, I think it was probably because it was extremely cold.
Uh-huh. Well, what success did you have with your experimental work as far as growing crops?
Well, we had excellent results. We grew all sorts of garden things, things that wouldn't winter kill. There aren't very many crops in here that want winter kill. That's our great trouble, is our constantly frozen ground.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that you were most successful with? Do you remember the
wheat and oats and barley, brome grass, Kentucky bluegrass, all of those things didn't. Well, some of the grains winter killed. We had to sow the grains in the spring, but the success with the summer grains was very, very encouraging, very wonderful.
Well, the Tanana Valley farm experiment work then began after you laid the groundwork at Rampart.
Oh, yes.
Well, what about progress here in the Tanana Valley? Now, earlier we discussed the Alaska potatoes, and I thought you came up with a bit of information that was rather interesting about the, you hear people say that Alaska potatoes turn black.
Yeah. Well,
you know, when they're left soaking in water.
Yeah. Well, our potatoes don't turn black, and I don't know any that do, although I hear about it. But I have put potatoes that we grew in Rampart where it's much colder than it is here, in the oven to bake, and I've had them burst all over the oven.
What causes that?
Mealy.
Being mealy.
Yes, mm-hmm. They're mealy.
Well, I always felt possibly it was the content of the water that affected the potato much more than the potato itself, just that it affects coffee and other beverages, depending upon the area of town that you live in.
No, I think it's the way they're grown.
You do?
Yes. I ought to know, but I don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, let's go back to this company that your brother worked for, the SYT,
SYT, Seattle Yukon Transportation Company.
Was that one of the very first
links
with Alaska?
One of the very first. It was organized just as soon as the gold boat came down to Seattle.
You say the gold boat. Now, what boat is that? You mean the first boatload of gold
mm-hmm.
came down?
Yeah.
Who organized it?
The companies up here, I don't know which company sent that boat down, but it came down loaded with gold, and of course there was terrible excitement. And Judge Wood, our mayor, went right down to San Francisco and hired the Humboldt to come up and take the crowds to St. Michael's. And then, of course, the river boats. One river boat was the Seattle, was built at Dutch Harbor. But that's the only one that I know of. There were some boats on the Yukon. I don't know now which ones they were.
Mm-hmm. The old stern wheeler type boat?
Yes. They were big boats. But I think it was the Hannah and the Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
But some of these old-timers may know that I'm wrong. I don't know.
That's one thing about this program. I have a couple of critics that just sit there every week trying to find something wrong. Usually.
Sure. Sure. And it's hard to remember all these things.
Oh, certainly it is.
You know?
I have trouble remembering what happened last year.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a bit about getting around from one place to another. When you and Mr. Gasser were there at Rampart, did you stay pretty close to home, or did you come into Fairbanks much?
Well, we came over here to have our teeth taken care of. That's all. And but otherwise, we stayed right home. Well, I went to Seattle when we had only been married a year. I would cry in my sleep for my sister's children. And so Mr. Gasser packed me up and sent me out to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed all summer. Then I came back, and then I was satisfied. And then the next time that we went out, we went together.
Mm-hmm.
The government gave him 5 months under full pay one time and 6 months another, because he didn't take his vacations, his yearly vacation, you see. And he was too busy, and there was no reason to do it anyway. And so then we were able to go out, and he went to to Berkeley, freshened up his work.
Well, it's an amazing thing to me how two people, both with good educations and good cultural background, could be happy for, how many years was it at Rampart?
17.
17 years. What did you find to do? Were you just happy among yourselves?
We took up so many different things. For instance, we took up the wild plants. He found that he must know the wild plants because he was constantly interrogated about them. Then Berkeley and Harvard sent a man in to get Lepidoptera, which is butterflies and moths.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent him right to hubby. And so I had good help in my house, and I spent all summer hunting butterflies and moths. And of course, I was taught to mount them. Mm-hmm. I have them out here. And that was very interesting. Then we, of course, we had lots of time evenings to read, and we had work among the Indian children. For instance, Mr. Gasser, they were killing squirrels and rabbits and all kinds of things, and Mr. Gasser organized a Saturday afternoon shooting class and taught the boys to shoot at marks. And they had a wonderful time. And the first time that they were over, I always had cocoa and cookies and things ready for the children whenever they came over. They didn't have any amusements, poor little things. And so that first Saturday, about 5 o'clock, I saw a bunch of girls coming across the river. And the boys said, "The girls are coming over to wash the dishes for you." So sure enough, every Saturday, 3 or 4 girls showed up to wash the dishes. They didn't leave it to me to do. Mm-hmm. Well, we gave Christmas parties. We'd send out for a box load of gifts for the children. And of all the things that they liked most were the little blocks with letters on them.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we'd have a supper for them. And there was one little girl that was quite fat, and she'd always sit. Every year, she'd sit at the table and eat and eat. And finally, she'd look at me so despairingly, and she'd say, "I don't want to eat anymore." And I'd say, "Well, you don't have to eat anymore." She never failed to announce that she had finished. The others would all be out playing.
Well, I wish we could go on and on with your story, Mrs. Gasser. I know that your work here in Fairbanks, your husband's work with the experimental people here in Fairbanks has been of great interest, but we're running short of time, and I think what we ought to do is catch that husband of yours and put him in front of a microphone and get the rest of the George Gasser story for you next week.
Well, he'll do a much better job than I will.
Well, I doubt that.
I'm not so sure that I want this to go on for me. I can't hear it, can I?
You'll see, you should be able to.